Well, I have a wonderful electronic invention I want you to see. It looks something like this.
Hey, what's going on, Curiosity Builders? I'm Chris Martin, and you're listening to Getting Work to Work, a weekly podcast for creative entrepreneurs. You know, makers, artists, filmmakers, designers, and coders who are on a mission of bringing their ideas to life by creating new things and getting their work to work. Whether you're just starting out or have been at this creative life for some time, I hope you'll learn something new in this podcast, challenge your assumptions about what is possible, and chase big ideas so you can become who you were born to be. How do you know if your marketing messages are impacting people? Enter neuromarketing, a type of marketing that combines direct response marketing with neuroscience, medical imagery, and the study of human behavior. This topic is the foundation of my conversation with Dan Russell, CEO and founder of Vivid Labs, in today's interview episode of Getting Work to Work. We start with talking about the ways business can improve humanity and why that's a passion for Dan, how understanding his values changed everything for his life and business, the role of perception and transparency in the communication of value, and the role ethics play in the study and creation of campaigns utilizing neuromarketing. Show notes and links to resources mentioned in this episode can be found at gwtw.co/302. You'll also find links to stream the show on the major podcast platforms and an opportunity to sign up for my email newsletter, The Curiosity Lab. Each week, I send out some thoughts on curiosity along with books, videos, podcasts, and other resources blowing my mind as well. Dan, welcome to Getting Work to Work. Why don't you share a little bit about who you are and the work you do?
Thanks, Chris. Super happy to be here. So my name is Dan Russell. I own a company called Vivid Labs. We're an experimental marketing agency that uses the scientific method and brain science to build marketing campaigns that win. And we do that with a wonderful team of super talented individuals, designers, technicians, and I head off the strategy and research section of that business. So we work really, really hard to put our knowledge and our tools to good use. And you know, there's a big piece of ethics when you come into the neuromarketing world. So we make sure that we're using our tools for good and not evil, and you know, improving humanity along the way.
Yeah. I like that you mentioned improving humanity, because I have to say that I really resonate with that level of passion. In your bio, you write that you're using business as a tool to improve humanity. And it's just refreshing to hear that perspective, as opposed to all business is bad, that sometimes comes across when people look at, you know, business. How does that passion inform the work you do with Vivid Labs?
Well, I can trace it back to, I think what would be helpful to add context is to trace it back to where it came from. When I first started the business, I one of the first groups, you know, sort of business networks that I ever entered was called the Mavericks, led by a guy named Yannick Silver. And Yannick wrote a book called Evolved Enterprise, which I read like early on. Like, it was one of the first business books I read after starting my business. And I read plenty leading up to that, but after I started the business was actually I could implement. And that book was all about using business as a tool for good and structuring your business in a way that means that when your business succeeds, that begets the improvement of the world in some way. It creates a positive impact in some way. And like an example of that is like Zappos, or a better example actually would be Tom's Shoes.
Yeah.
Buy a pair, give a pair sort of thing. Or there's a company that makes handbags out of old recycled fire department hoses. And, you know, different things that you know, when you really look closely into the business structure, you realize, oh, like they have incorporated philanthropy. And if not philanthropy, then just overall positive humanitarian impact into their business model. So like if they're operating, if they're doing what they do, if they are making money, if they are serving their customers in any way, they're also improving the world in some way. They're not destroying, they're building.
Yeah.
So that's where that comes from for me. And it's a huge part of my philosophy, and it's ingrained itself into my mind, because, you know, this is the first of many companies that I'll start, and I want every single one of them to sort of be at the crossroads between emerging technology and humanitarian impact. So I feel like the bigger my company can get, the bigger companies like mine can get, then the better the world will be.
Yeah. Wow. That's awesome. I mean, have you always operated from this sense of passion and, you know, really believing in your core values and what you believe to that you can do with business and with your work?
No. I had to go through a lot of like existential discovery to figure out what my core values were. Yeah. And to identify like what I stood for and what I wanted to do. When I was in my early 20s, specifically after I graduated from college, I was sort of blindly ambitious. I was just like, I would work on things just to work on things because I wanted to build. And at one point or another, I sort of like looked up from my desk and was like, where is this all going? Like, what am I doing? I would like stay up until 2 a.m. building this, you know, weird website that because I found a cool domain name that I thought was really interesting and quirky. And then I would wake up Saturday morning and look at it and be like, why did I just spend 6.5 hours doing it? So like stuff like that. So I jumped into the personal development world very early on. And started attending events, surrounding myself with highly developed people who helped me identify what those core values are and helped me figure out what lights me up. And that's in many ways why we went into the space that we're in with neuromarketing, because I didn't want to just be another digital marketing agency. That's like the most boring thing in the world for me. I want us to be differentiated. I want us to be on the cutting edge. Like I said, you know, intersection of cutting edge tech and humanitarian impact. So that's it continues to inform our philosophy and our business model.
Yeah. So you've mentioned neuromarketing. What is that?
So neuromarketing is the combination of traditional direct response marketing that you would see in a show like Mad Men, David Ogilvy sort of stuff, and neuroscience research. So if you're familiar with guys like Daniel Kahneman or Dana Reilly, who wrote Predictably Irrational, one of the more popular behavioral economics books out there. But like, you know, science of human behavior sort of stuff. So it's the intersection of those two worlds. And then I'm going to add a third circle onto this Venn diagram of medical imaging technology. And the reason I say that is because in the last 5 to 10 years, medical technology that's able to see inside our brains and read our brain waves, such as, you know, functional magnetic resonance imaging, fMRIs, electroencephalography, EEGs, these are tools that have gotten accurate enough that marketers have started to pay attention and say, and they're now able to say, okay, well, you know, we want to run a Super Bowl spot, but a couple million bucks to do that. Why don't we, you know, spend $100,000 or $200,000 putting, you know, a couple dozen people or a couple hundred people through this MRI machine and see how our commercial actually makes them feel.
Yeah.
And so you can see through those scans where, at least in the case of a fMRI, you can see where the blood is flowing in their brains, because blood has hemoglobin, hemoglobin has iron, iron has a magnetic, you know, reaction. And so the machine can read that and see where the blood is flowing. So neuromarketing, this is a very long answer, but neuromarketing is the intersection of those three worlds. Wow. And it's actually a much smaller portion of the marketing world, mostly because it's lesser known, but partially because it's, you know, that sort of medical side is very much in the realm of Fortune 500 budgets. So what we spend the majority of our time doing in the neuromarketing world is actually conducting research reviews of guys like Dan Ariely and institutions like Duke, who are releasing new studies and new reports. you know, we're reading, you know, psychology research publications, and then translating all of that research into practical marketing strategies that we then test for our clients. Mm-hmm. And that's why we're called Vivid Labs, because we're experimentation based, and those experiments that we use are based on marketing campaign ideas that mm-hmm. are based on the science of human behavior. And we have like an ethics filter that we put things through to make sure that nothing nefarious gets through. But that's sort of the answer to what is neuromarketing.
That's awesome. And what got you interested in that? I mean,
just curiosity.
Yeah. I mean, how do you come across that in your curiosity journey?
Well, early on in the agency, I was frustrated because we were just another digital marketing agency. Like I said, that's the most boring thing in the world for me. And, and you know, it was keeping the lights on, but it wasn't making an impact. It wasn't doing anything big or exciting. So I started getting frustrated because we would have these, one of the things that we do for our clients is run product launches. Mm-hmm. And when we ran a product launch, it would be like a make or break scenario, right? Like you spend months and months and months writing copy, building pages, installing automations, mm-hmm. you know, all this stuff to build a campaign whose success is predicated on like three emails that go out over 3 days, you know, wow. Like all of the eggs were in one basket. And I got so frustrated that I was like, there's gotta be a better way to do this. So I actually broke open some old development textbooks, because in college I studied finance and technology management, and that latter piece was all about managing development teams. And so I started reading up a little bit more on the agile framework, rapid iteration, rapid testing. Mm-hmm. And so we started incorporating those lessons into our launch framework, and eventually developed a method that allows our clients to invest significantly less into their marketing campaigns upfront. It's just a better ROI. You know, we can sleep at night, they can sleep at night knowing that there's a plan, because there's nothing worse, you know, there's no worse feeling as a marketer to, you know, spend all this time on strategy and building things and then see it all fall flat on its face. Yeah. So we basically have an alpha launch stage, a beta launch stage, and a full launch stage to every campaign that we run. And then in each of those stages, we're just validating different steps of the marketing campaign through those experiments that I was talking about.
Wow. I mean, I really appreciate that you felt a disconnect with, you know, doing marketing, digital marketing as usual, and really, I guess, trying to find that point of differentiation. And not only that, but that point of just like straight up what lights you up inside.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm like a very technical person. I like to get in the weeds, although mm-hmm. I am the visionary type. Mm-hmm. I'll very quickly get into the details, and I mm-hmm. love just getting lost in the details. So this was sort of, you know, brain crack for me. And I had an excuse for my project manager to spend hours and hours doing research, and, you know, my project manager is the one that keeps me from getting in the weeds and getting distracted, because I'm the one who's supposed to be, you know, out there and making new relationships, going to events, pursuing new opportunities, mm-hmm. thinking big. But like when I find something that I'm like, oh, I really want to run with this, then I will spend days just like devouring it.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Do you like have an ideal structure to your day that allows you to wear the visionary hat and then allow yourself time to get lost in the weeds? Or
yeah, so I've got it's basically sections of my calendar every day mm-hmm. blocked out. In the mornings, I've got basically what I call maker time. I think I stole this from Tim Ferriss, but from morning till noon, basically till noon every day, I don't take any calls. And nice. The only meeting I'll attend is for a weekly level 10 meeting for our team, which is like mm-hmm. a sort of like all hands meeting, leadership meeting. So that time is reserved for me to get my stuff done, to think big, to write, to do whatever I need to do. to push the company forward. And then from 12 to 5, and there's some subsets to that depending on the team's availability, but from 12 to 5, I can take calls and go to meetings and do all the things that, you know, are more outward facing for the business. But I find that that's just a really good, you know, template to follow for me. And then I just have a morning routine with my fiance Melanie. And we call it quits around 5:30 or 6 every day. I used to be like the opposite of this. Before I met my fiance, I would be up until like 3 a.m. every day and sleeping in until like, I don't know, 8, 9, and always being exhausted, no control over my time. So this was sort of like a hard learned lesson and discipline.
Yeah. Since you mentioned Melanie, we've had her on the show in the past. And what's fascinating is like you're both visionary types. So, I mean, what happens when the two of you brainstorm together?
Sparks fly. We actually do it quite often. We've got, we have a weekly Monday morning coffee walk that we'll take. And we actually have, you know, we try to do it more often than that, but that'll be our time to essentially brainstorm and see what's coming up this week. How can I help you? How can you help me? And then, you know, as things come up, we definitely will brainstorm it. Like she's been helping me with a recent project and I've been helping her with a recent project. So I used to be a little bit like before I met her, I had a no dating entrepreneurs rule because I was so scared that like, and it happened to me at one point. That's where the rule came from. I was dating this girl in New York City and it seemed like every time we like went out on a date, it would turn into like a work session. And it was always like we would always be talking about work. And at one point I'm like, this is not going anywhere. This is not working. This is not making me feel like I should be feeling. So I'm really grateful that we've figured out a way to do it.
Yeah, that's cool. I'm glad that you figured out a way to work on that because it can probably be so freeing to feel like you don't have to like solve the business problems and you can just look at life.
Right. Yeah. There's definitely boundaries in place and those are very healthy boundaries.
Yeah, that's great. One of the things that I love is looking at your website for Vivid Labs. I love how transparent you are specifically with showing your prices publicly. And that definitely goes against the grain of 99.99999% of marketing agencies. So why did you decide to do that?
We decided to do that because number one, we are a premium service and that is a, you know, it's not something that we are ashamed of or that we try to like, you know, pull people in for. You know, when you know, like from a perception standpoint, when you know that there's a product that has a high price, then you know the value that's ascribed to that product versus having, you know, an unknown price in your head where, you know, you don't know what level it's at in terms of investment. And then you have an unknown perceived value, at least in that little part of your brain that attaches price to value, right? Yeah. The second reason is it qualifies people who reach out to us. Like if we get a lead through the website, we know that they saw our prices. So we don't have to have a whole conversation about it. There's no discounting. There's no like, you know, back and forth. So it just weeds out the tire kickers and the people who, you know, want to, you know, give us equity in their business for, you know, free marketing services, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah. I was wondering too, as I was reading it, I'm like, is this a component of neuromarketing as well? Cause it's like,
yeah, there's a little bit of all that stuff dotted throughout the website. Yeah.
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 That's cool. How have your customers responded to this level of transparency?
Well, I mean, we don't honestly hear anything about it, from our clients, you know, if you're referencing just the website stuff, when we get a new lead through the website, or, you know, somebody reaches out to us, they say, hey, I checked out your website. You know, this looks great. And would love to talk about it. And that's all that really needs to happen. But, you know, we've got other examples of transparency, you know, throughout the business. But mm-hmm. In that particular case, it's sort of like not in their brain space.
Yeah. And I'm curious too. It's like you mentioned transparency at the website level, and then transparency through every level of the relationship. I mean, is that refreshing to them? I mean, I imagine it has to be.
Oh yeah, I mean that's you know one of our whole you know principles is own your shit, and we take responsibility for our actions, mm-hmm. successes and failures. We make sure that we communicate with the client, even if they're wrong, and we tell them if they're wrong, or if we think they're wrong, or if we made a mistake, because mm-hmm. I've been in the position where I've experienced the opposite of that and been on the receiving end and the creation end of it, not on purpose, but, you know, because of insecurity. So mm-hmm. I sort of understand the whole complexity and mistrust and stress that is created without transparency. So, mm-hmm. you know, I'll have very frank conversations with our clients and be very upfront about whether or not something is working, whether or not it, you know, it's still a good idea to be working together. Those tough conversations, mm-hmm. I learned a long time ago to like, it's much easier for me to do now, but you know, a long time ago it would be like paralyzing to yeah. have a transparent conversation with a client, because there's this, you know, perceived idea in our minds, I guess, as business owners, like the customer's always right. The customer's always right. The customer's always mm-hmm. right. Don't piss off the customer. Mm-hmm. You know, tread lightly, you know, you're walking on thin ice, that sort of thing. Yeah. And that's just like, I let go of that completely, because at the end of the day, we're a business service company, and mm-hmm. we're servicing people, and people trust people. And the way that you build trust is through frank honesty and just being a real human being.
Yeah. Like, what was it like to have to shed that fear and that paralyzing nature of those conversations in the beginning?
Just had to power through it in my case. Wow. You know, it's like there are certain unavoidable conversations, right? You mm-hmm. know, we've all had them.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you have a couple of unavoidable conversations, and then you have a few avoidable conversations that, you know, you should have, but, you know, you can kick the can down the road and it won't come back and bite you. At least you don't think so. I had a partner in the business a couple of years ago, who's no longer a partner, primarily because our values weren't aligned, and he was distracted, and I started getting, you know, really just resentful. And so that was a conversation that I was avoiding mm-hmm. and I knew I could avoid it. But at the same time, I knew that it was costing the business. It was costing me. So eventually, I'm like, all right, we're having this conversation. We got to split up and part ways mm-hmm. and other circumstances have come up like that. But it's just a muscle that you got to develop and figure out, you know, what battles you're going to pick in the near term, what can wait. But at the end of the day, for me, it's so much easier because I just know it's honest. And mm-hmm. whatever comes out of my mouth, I know it's going to be honest. Even if it ends up being that, you know, we part ways with a client or somebody gets mad at me. I'm a people pleaser and that hurts. But yeah. the pleasure of being honest outweighs that pain for me.
Yeah. So as you've taken on honesty, transparency, being authentic and building trust, how has that made you a better leader to your team?
It humanizes me, I think. The honesty and the transparency, it humanizes me and it builds more loyalty because, mm-hmm. you know, with the team, if the business is a black box, and we have a lot of contractors, so mm-hmm. if the business is a black box, then you can't have a culture.
Yeah.
And if there's, not a black box. The opposite of a black box would just be like, you know, I guess a glass box, but you know what I mean? Like yeah. where you sort of know where everything's at and you have a grasp of like where things are and where things are going and who's in charge and what the plan is, then all of a sudden people start to get a little bit more excited and engaged and, you know, willing to go to great lengths to support you.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. So is your company primarily remote?
Yeah, we're fully remote. We're going to be actually establishing a little bit of a stronger presence in Denver coming up this year, primarily because we're expecting a big influx of clients in August. So I want to have like everybody able to meet up in one place, get a co-working space cool. if we need to. But you know, for the last 4 years, we've been 100% virtual company.
Yeah, that's great. That's the impression that I got when I was looking through your site, was just that you had made a focus on attracting the best talent across the country, as opposed to, just tapping from the local pool.
Yeah. And I mean, that was born out of necessity when I started the business, because I had to hire freelancers because I didn't have any money to hire anybody full time. Mm-hmm. So, you know, my options were Craigslist or back then, I think it was Elance before yeah. Upwork ate it up. So I went on Elance and I started, you know, looking for people and mistakenly made a full-time hire when I definitely should not have for my first hire as a copywriter. And I'm like, it was totally an ego thing too. I'm like, well, in order to be a real business, I have to have a full-time employee. Not true. Yep. But that was the first, and then brought on some more contract basis team members, and then the project manager, and so on and so forth.
As you think about the pivot that you had to make from going from a traditional company to one focused on core values and improving humanity, what do you think are some of the successful steps in making a pivot from one pursuit to another?
Well, I'll speak to the pivot in terms of our differentiation with the neuromarketing piece, and I'll just speak a little bit more generally. So, okay. So with the switch to the neuromarketing piece, a large amount of responsibility for that pivot was on my shoulders, if not 100%. And so I had to own it because I was the one that cared the most about it. I'm sure that, you know, there were members of our team which, you know, wouldn't have even understood what I was talking about when I was saying neuromarketing back in that period of time, right? Mm-hmm. So I had to own it and I had to run with it. But you know, that commitment was why, that was the reason that we were able to successfully pivot. I didn't delegate that. That's not something that you delegate as a CEO. That's on your shoulders.
Yeah.
So that's definitely, I think, the main principle of pivoting. If you're thinking about, you know, changing the direction of the business, like, it starts with you. Another big element is just organizational structure. I learned a lot from Entrepreneurial Operating System, EOS. It was from a book called Traction by Gina Wickman. And that was sort of like a helpful guide in terms of how to structure your team and meeting rhythms and so on. So, you know, in terms of business structure differentiation, that's what I would say. You know, the pivot is on your shoulders. Mm-hmm. In terms of pivoting in general, the pivot has to be an organizational buy-in. And so an example of that would be when we introduced a new workshop in the agency. We've got this workshop called Launch Lab. And we introduced that in June of last year, so just about a year ago. And there were many strategic reasons for it, but it involved flying out my project manager. We now fly out the copywriter to the client's location. Like, we stay overnight for 2 nights. And so like, it was a big, you know, shift from our structure as a virtual marketing company. And actually the first time that we did that workshop was the first time I met my project manager in person.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so, which is crazy. But the organizational buy-in behind that was strong because I explained the strategy. I explained, like, this is going to be, you know, a profitable venture for us. It's going to be one that establishes a really strong, deep emotional relationship with these clients that increases the odds of them staying with us and continuing to work with us. So I explained all, all these things, the strategy behind it. And then people started to get excited because they then started to see more client flow and, mm-hmm. and more work for our contract basis team members and more stability and uniform projects for our full-time team members. So, you know, that I would say, you know, the pivot in that circumstance was wholly reliant on the organizational buy-in, on the full team.
And I imagine as you're going through this transition, you're introducing a new workshop and you're like, maybe you're thinking, wow, this actually works. Yes. Which fuels new ideas, I imagine.
Yeah, it feels great. That's sort of like the high that we search for as entrepreneurs is, hey, I invented this idea. I just came up with this mm-hmm. and people are now paying me for it. And the business is surviving because of it. You know, we created something from nothing.
Yeah.
There's a huge high associated with that for sure.
Yeah. So what keeps you grounded again? Is it your relationship with Melanie that keeps you grounded from, you know, getting that exaggerated ego of I came up with this and I can do no wrong?
I think first and foremost, it's because of my upbringing. You know, I'm a humble guy, and I don't say that, you know, in an egotistical way, but every time somebody says, I'm so authentic. Humble.
I'm the okay, most humblest person.
But you know, I think humility and gratitude are two of my big character traits. So I practice that a lot. I think those two things are what keep me grounded on the most basic fundamental, you know, level. Mm-hmm. And then there is my relationship with Melanie because mm-hmm. she and I are around each other all the time and we see the ups and the downs and we're there all the time to support each other. And so that's, mm-hmm. that would be the sort of third pillar.
As you mentioned, just your upbringing and humility and gratitude. What's interesting is, you know, taking this back to that question of ethics. What's fascinating is, like, since you're so grounded, that ethical conversation between marketing and neuromarketing makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
And I'm curious if you've had to draw a line in the sand that you won't cross between, you know, good decisions and evil decisions.
Well, there's always in my mind, there's always an unethical strategy that I can come up with. Hmm. Just the way that my brain processes these research reports that I'm reading through, I'm like, oh, you could do that. Oh, that would be totally evil. You know? So that's sort of the first line of defense. I've got a whole database of strategies that, you know, we keep a library of them. And I used to put in the unethical ones too. And I just mark them as like not approved. I don't even put them in now because, like, why even put it on paper? So yeah. That's essentially how I handle that. There are more established methods of enforcing ethics. There's an organization called NMSBA, the Neuromarketing Science and Business Association, and they have a code of ethics that they've published specifically for the world of neuromarketing because it can be abused. Like, you know, there's just stuff that, you know, easiest example is fake news. You know, a very simple psychological principle is that if you get told something enough times, you start to believe it, even if it's not true, even if you know it's not true. You'll start to believe it if you hear it enough times. So, like, you know, during the Trump campaign a couple years ago, he said he kept referring to Hillary Clinton as something Hillary, Lying Hillary or something like that.
Something like that, yeah.
And I saw that, and the first time I saw it, I'm like, okay, he's just, you know, being obnoxious. And then he kept doing it. And I realized what he was doing, which is exactly what I was just talking about. He just continually put Hillary's name next to the word lying, and people start to believe she's a liar. Now, that sort of thing, you know, in isolation, you know, it can do enough damage, but to think about how many opportunities there are for nefarious people to use science to take advantage of people, manipulate people, and so on. It's not like hypnotic. It's not like hypnotizing, neuro-linguistic programming, anything like that. Like, that stuff is so blown out of proportion, it's not even funny. But the subtler stuff, like that, can, you know, be used for evil. So, you know, we just don't even engage it.
Yeah,
I don't even bring it into the business.
Yeah, that's cool. And I think from the standpoint of, I think, just humanity and looking at it as, you know, we know we're being sold to, and we know that we're being sold in more and more, I'll say, interesting and scary ways. You know, it's nice to know that there is an ethical boundary with companies like yours that, you know, want to improve the reliability of marketing campaign without flat out manipulating people.
Oh yeah. And the way that I see it is that neuromarketing is equally powerful in its ability to manipulate as it is its ability to create such engaging content that in an incomparable way.
Yeah.
You know, when you look in history, if you put a Dove ad next to, you know, these days, next to a Dove ad from 30 years ago, I don't even know if Dove was around 30 years ago, but you know what I'm saying? Yeah. It's totally different. It's totally different. And the reason it's different is because we understand that story drives our emotional engagement. We understand that there are certain elements of video production and methods of video editing that keep us paying attention. We understand that certain topics are more inflammatory or more enticing or more arousing than others. And we know all of this because of science. We know it because we've been able to look at the granular details, whereas in the 60s and the 70s, they didn't have that data. But at the end of the day, I think that I personally love where advertising is going. I love, you know, the only reason I watch the Super Bowl is to watch the commercials. I go into YouTube rabbit holes, just, you know, watching really emotional commercials, right? Would you have ever said that even 15 years ago, 20 years ago?
Probably not.
Right? You know, Coke and Pepsi were the first ones to do, like, not first ones, but, like, you know, to have those, like, longer form story-based, you know, commercials. But now everybody's doing it. You know, Heineken is dealing with, like, transgender issues, and Dove is dealing with women's beauty and these really deep emotional topics that you wouldn't see that, you know, 30 years ago. It didn't exist. Like, I've looked, it wasn't that deep, because number one, we didn't have the technology to, you know, disseminate video content in the way we do today, but also we just didn't have the knowledge and the data and the science to say this is a commercial that's really going to rock versus this commercial is not.
I like it because it really, one of the ongoing struggles in the creative world is, how do you communicate the return on investment with your work to a business? And with neuromarketing, it's like there is the ROI. The ROI is in the research and the data and what you've really learned about telling stories that connect to humanity. I think that's really awesome.
Yeah.
I'm also thinking about something that Ken Burns said in a video, that storytelling is lying 24 frames per second, and that he you know, you're feeling a certain way and he manipulated you to feel that way, but there's good manipulation and bad manipulation.
Yep.
It's just really interesting.
And we've been doing it for as long as, you know, we've been telling stories.
Yeah.
Stories are a way for us to engage a different set of emotions and empathize. You know, if we hear a story about a stillborn baby, we feel tragic loss. And you just hear those words, right? Just hear, you just hear the words, stillborn baby. I'm going to stop saying it now. And you feel that, but then you feel, then you imagine, you know, a mother holding their healthy newborn baby in her arms, right? And you feel a completely different set of emotions, joy, ecstatic joy for new life. And if you're telling a story, you're doing the same thing, but like you could call it manipulation, but you know, at the end of the day, like it's a story. And it, you know, you could take that so far as to say, anytime you're communicating with anyone, you're manipulating them. Whenever somebody like brings up that topic, like the manipulation topic, I sort of go into this, you know, error zone. Like, well, if you're going to call that manipulation, then what about this? And then what about this? Yeah. And then what about this? For me, it comes down to the ethics. You know, we're always manipulating. We always are. We want to manipulate. We want to be manipulated. That's the human experience. But whether or not, as you brought up earlier, is it ethical or unethical? That's the important question.
Yeah. And I think that's the important question, I think, to ask in our digital world is just the one of ethics, because the line gets fuzzier and fuzzier with some things. And we need the hard lines of ethics to keep us in line.
Yeah. Yeah, we do, because it can get carried away otherwise.
Yeah. That's awesome. Well, Dan, this has been a fun conversation.
Likewise.
You've really blown my mind in some ways. And I've got two questions. One is related to fMRIs. When you are talking about different stories and different emotions through all of your research, can you start like visualizing the fMRI patterns that you've looked at with relating to different emotions?
I probably not. That would be a whole other level of nerddom. But now that you say that, I sort of want to be at that level.
Cause as you were describing it, I'm like, I wonder if he's looking like, is the joy center like lit up right now?
I know the names of the parts, but not the, like locations. I don't have like this mental image.
That's awesome. Well, last question for you, Dan, what was the last book or podcast that lit up your mind?
You know, the last one that completely blew my mind was called Reality Is Not What It Seems by Carlo Rovelli. It is my favorite book of all time. Oh, and it is about quantum gravity. Now, before I scare you off.
Not scared, just curious.
This is a physicist, an Italian quantum physicist who writes like a poet.
Ooh.
And he writes about science, and he doesn't throw equations at you or anything like that. He describes the world in a way that you have never heard it described before. He explains how small things get. He explains how big things get. He explains how time works and, you know, how everything around us exists. And that's like one of my hobbies, just like, is just reading books like that because it's just freaking fascinating. And it's the one thing that blows my mind every single time I think about it. Like nothing else blows my mind every time I think about it, except quantum physics and time.
Well, and what a powerful way to expand your mind, you know, in many ways.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Because you start questioning everything. Like, why am I here? What are we doing here? How did we get here?
Well, on that note, thank you so much, Dan, for being a guest on Getting Work to Work. I've thoroughly enjoyed this conversation, and I'm definitely going to go check out that book because it sounds like a good mind blower.
Awesome. Well, thank you for having me, man. Glad to be here. And thanks for the time.
I hope this interview with Dan inspires you to be on the lookout for new ways that you can differentiate your business and have an impact on humanity. Remember, the direction of your business starts with you. Until next time, may creativity and curiosity fuel your life.